Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 3, Episode 17, The New and Improved Yamato State. An important aspect to recognize in the great drama of the Soga clan in the Asuka period is that our main sources are primarily from Nara period imperial-sponsored histories, whose authors would have every incentive to demonize any previous enemies of the court. The Soga domination of the first 100 years of the Asuka period may not have been quite as tyrannical as it was portrayed in the National Chronicles. On the other hand, their tendency to murder potentially problematic royal heirs may also have not been as terribly outside the ordinary in the late 500s and early 600s as it became later. That being said, it's also not as though the Ishii incident put an end to regicide as a means of power transfer throughout Japan thereafter. Historians who study the Asuka period today generally believe that the Soga clan was responsible for importing Buddhism, but not necessarily for the other political innovations which followed. It makes sense to imagine that once their primary goals were accomplished and the leaders of their clan wielded nearly absolute power throughout the realm, they were satisfied with this status quo and not eager to invite any other foreign ideas which might potentially threaten them. The Nihon Shoki claims that many Japanese sovereigns during the early Asuka period wholeheartedly adopted Buddhism, piously sponsoring temples and monastic orders, as well as becoming regular practitioners themselves. The late Donald McCallum, in his work The Four Great Temples, paints a rather different picture from the sanitized post-facto histories. According to McCallum, the Soga clan was the primary sponsor of Buddhism, and there is little real evidence that monarchs like Queen Kogyoku and even members of the royal family like Prince Shotoku actually adopted the new faith in any meaningful way at all. He credits King Jomei with commissioning the great temple Kudara Odera, but even this gesture may have been motivated more by politics than piety. Kudara Odera was primarily staffed by monks and nuns who were gradually returning to Japan after spending a dozen or more years training in China. They brought with them not only a more Chinese style of Buddhism, but also books about Confucianism and legalism, as well as their stories from years of living in a centralized nation with dynamic and charismatic monarchs directing the course of state. All this is to say that it is important to know the official story, but it is likewise important to investigate the messy truth behind the incredibly tidy and sanitized versions that came much later. By the time the Nihon Shoki was written, Buddhism had grown into a powerful force in its own right, one which frequently interfered with politics at court. It's fair to assume that the history writers would have been quite unable to conceive of a Japan without Buddhism, and may have thus credited the royal family with their enlightened wisdom at having adopted and championed the faith. The sponsorship of Buddhism by Japan's noble class led to some surprising figures. By 627, just 75 years after its official introduction, Japan was home to 46 Buddhist temples, monasteries, and shrines. By 692, just 65 years later, that number had ballooned to 545. The Japanese monks who trained in China helped to import Chinese ideas, so let's discuss what some of those ideas were, and how the Japanese adapted them to their existing cultural practices. We'll start with cosmology. Chinese cosmology has a rich and multifaceted history. We'll start with one of its oldest and most familiar symbols, the yin and yang. Discovered as two separate symbols on divination turtle shells from the Shang dynasty in the 1200s BCE, it is believed that the earliest interpretation was understood to be day and night. Over time, the white day portion of the symbol represented activity and energy, while the black night portion meant rest and stillness. These meanings have continued to evolve over time, as the symbol came to be understood as a representation of the natural balance between all things. The Han Dynasty records a contemporary philosophical school called Yin-Yang, which was founded during the spring and autumn periods of the Zhou Dynasty. This school promoted the idea that the universe and everything in it had a natural equilibrium, including human society. Harmony was the result of a proper balance of yin and yang, and disharmony was caused by an imbalance between the two. This idea that the universe itself is governed by equal amounts of opposing forces is a fascinating one, and many subsequent schools took inspiration from yin-yang to inform their approach to everything from medicine to governance. Despite how specialized some of the yin-yang influenced schools of thought became, the big idea of balancing extremes was easy to understand and held a certain innate comfort for the common people as well as the powerful. Yin-yang philosophy spawned far too many methods of divination to list them all comfortably here. Arguably the most famous is the I Ching, or Book of Changes, which incorporates combinations of six broken or solid lines, which are called hexagrams, to reveal a person's fortune. In Japan's emerging government of the late 600 CE, yin-yang would get its very own sub-department, which was dedicated to divining natural phenomena. The Yamato court post-Ishii incident gradually reorganized itself, installing Chinese ideas of statecraft and mingling them with indigenous sensibilities. The resulting criminal and administrative code is called Ritsu-ryō in Japanese. By the end of the Asuka period, the court could be described thus. Just below the king was the Daijo Daijin, or Chancellor, who along with four great counselors called Dainagon and three minor counselors called Shonagon directed the big-picture affairs of state. Next, there were two branches of government. The left, which dealt primarily with religious matters like ceremonies and civic business, and the right, which dealt with secular matters like preparing for war and executing justice. These were not co-equal branches. The secular branch of the right was subordinate to the religious branch of the left. This was one area where the government of Japan differed from the Tang Dynasty, whom they sought to emulate, and it's not hard to see why. In China, it had long been established that the ruler was an agent of the gods, and thus expected to behave in an ethical and upright manner, or said gods would arrange for their overthrow and replacement. In Japan, a sovereign was believed to be a god on earth, not merely a representative, and the Tenno's legitimacy was based solely on their lineage. The various clans of the Yamato court were ambitious, to be sure, but they were still very much invested in upholding the sovereign's inherited legitimacy, because they expected said monarch to uphold their own inherited legitimacy in turn. The left branch was called Jingikan, and the right branch Dajokan. The minister of the left, called the Sadaijin, was the second most powerful person in the nation, and the third was the minister of the right, called the Udaijin. Below them were controllers of the left and right, Sadaiben and Udaiben, respectively, who each presided directly over four government ministries. On the left was the Ministry of the Center, the Ministry of Ceremony, the Ministry of Civil Affairs, and the Ministry of People's Affairs. On the right was the Ministry of Military Affairs, the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of the Treasury, and the Ministry of the Royal Household. A distinctly Confucian innovation which was introduced at this time was an examination system. Don't get too excited, though. While public education and rigorous merit-based competition undergirded the Tang Dynasty's version of Confucian bureaucracy, the Yamato court accepted the idea of requiring rigorous examinations for various degrees of government service, and then automatically granted exemptions from the tests for the sons of nobles, and did not at this point invest any state resources toward even a modest universal education system. In fact, in 682, an edict boldly declared that the factors of consideration for inclusion in state service would be ancestry, character, and capability, in that order. The aristocracy in Japan was still very committed to preserving its own power, regardless of whether the Tang Dynasty would approve. The next target of the reformers was the land itself. The country was divided into 66 provinces and 592 counties, and the court declared that the sovereign himself was imbued with the authority to appoint provincial governors as he saw fit. Practically speaking, however, little changed in terms of who claimed authority over different places. In most cases, the monarch simply appointed the already entrenched regional leaders to be the official governors of the lands over which their families had probably been ruling for decades, even centuries. In addition to being practical, this maneuver was also smart because the Yamato court absolutely did not have the military strength necessary to punish any provinces who refused their official governors. And, over time, some of the families who ruled in the provinces came to depend upon the emperor's official seal of approval as part of their local legitimacy. Again, following the Tang Dynasty's lead, the court ordered regions to be surveyed and censuses taken for the purposes of agricultural land redistribution. This balancing was initially meant to be done at certain intervals, but this quickly proved unworkable for a government who was trying to organize at a level that far outpaced their capabilities. While this may have helped break the power of some larger landowners for a short time, the allotments given to the farmers were often insufficient to both keep themselves and their families fed, while also honoring the government's demand for a portion of their harvest. This brings us to taxation. The Yamato government exempted Buddhist temples and indigenous shrines from paying any sort of tax on the land they occupied. Likewise, the sovereign could grant a gift of autonomous, tax-free land to anyone he wished. The land under both of these examples is called a shōen, and they will eventually become a huge headache for future governments. The social problems this system created were considerable. Every time the total area of taxable land was reduced, the taxes on those lands that remained would have to be increased to make up the shortfall. Thus, more farmers would seek to be relieved of their tax burden by donating their land to a nearby temple and then providing a much smaller portion of their harvest as rent instead of taxes. As you can probably surmise, this is a cycle that will have serious consequences for future leaders. The Ritsu part of Ritsu-ryō referred to the criminal code, much of which was directly imported from that of the Tang Dynasty. There were 5 levels of punishments which were assigned depending on the severity of the crime. Caning, which involved striking the convict's buttocks with a rattan cane a predetermined number of times. Public caning, which usually involved more strikes than the previous level. Imprisonment for up to 3 years. Exile. And capital punishment, which was accomplished either by hanging or beheading. There was also a caste system which was put in place, but we'll go into more detail about this aspect of the Ritsu-ryō next season, when the enforcement of these laws catches up with the court's ideals. In order to designate the eligibility of candidates to fill roles in various ministries throughout the national government, over 30 ranks were assigned to the various aristocratic families and lower gentry. These ranks, in which smaller numbers are ranked higher, determined one's eligibility for serving in certain offices. The primary ranks that mattered were the first through fifth rank, occupied by the conservative aristocracy. Scrappy, lower-ranked functionaries could earn higher ranks by working hard, but it was very rare for anyone to advance higher than the sixth rank without themselves hailing from a family of good pedigree. Again, we see the Japanese aristocrats modifying a tong system to suit their needs and keep any would-be threats to their power and influence well below the sixth rank. Something I have not yet explained is why the latter portion of the Yamato period is named the Asuka period. The name Asuka refers to an area within the Yamato region where the ruling dynasty held court. You may have noticed in preceding narrative that the court relocated periodically. Because of the negative associations with death, whenever a sovereign would die, the court would relocate. Generally, they stayed within Yamato, though hopefully you'll recall the exception of King Kotoku, who settled his court in Naniwa, present-day Osaka, after his coronation following the Ishii incident. This was a radical departure from familiar terrain and was likely influenced by the fact that Kotoku came to power in a coup. Among his many other innovations for consolidating imperial power, Emperor Temmu also arranged for the construction of a new capital. By 682, ground had been broken on the new seat of power, which I mentioned in the last episode is remembered as Fujiwara-kyo, but at the time was named Aramashi-kyo. As a quick point of translation here, the suffix kyo means capital, so when you hear a place name with kyo at the end, that's usually a capital. Aramashi-kyo was built on the ancestral lands of the Nakatomi clan and was the first Japanese capital to follow a grid layout, another Chinese-influenced decision, as the Tang capital Chang'an was similarly planned. However, Temmu Tenno would never lay eyes upon his dream palace, as construction was far from finished when he passed away in 686. After a brief delay in progress, Empress Jito lobbied for the city to be finished, and in 694 she moved the court to Aramashi-kyo and its newly made palace and dwellings. For many years, it was believed that Aramashi-kyo was relatively small, but recent excavations have revealed that it was around 5 square kilometers, that's a little over 3 square miles, American listeners. While certainly dwarfed by the average modern city, this is still a fairly large project which was intended to be a permanent capital. Empress Jito died there in 703, and her son Emperor Mommu followed suit in 707. Aramashi-kyo's status as a permanent capital, however, would not last through the reign of a third Tenno. The end of the Asuka period is generally marked by the move from Aramashi-kyo in the Asuka area of the Yamato region to a new capital named Heijo-kyo, which was meant to serve as the new permanent capital. We'll look more closely at the construction of Heijo-kyo next season, but for now, let's just give it a brief overview. Heijo-kyo, like many things of this period, was modeled after a Chinese pattern. Specifically, it was designed to match the Tang capital Chang'an, albeit at a much smaller scale than that mighty city. There can be little doubt that part of this effort was motivated by a desire to force China to recognize Japan's independence, but it would be reductive to assume that this was the only reason. It's common to read in sweeping regional histories that Japan was conforming its culture to that of China, but as we've already seen, this process was far from wholesale adoption. For an example of Japanese adaptation of Chinese culture, we need look no further than Taoism. From its roots as an ancient philosophy dedicated to seemingly self-contradictory wisdom, Taoism evolved into an institutional religion in China with imperial backing. You may remember that in the early 600s, the Tang Dynasty sent a delegation to Koguryo that included Taoist masters. While the Tang tolerated and, to a certain extent, supported Buddhism, Taoism remained the primary religious authority throughout their lands. Eventually, Buddhism and Taoism will come into conflict, but now we're getting ahead of ourselves. Although the Tang would also try to encourage the establishment of institutional Taoism in Japan, the Yamato court seems to have no interest in supplanting yet another new religion into their land, complete with temples, orders, hierarchies, and everything that came along with it. They were interested, however, in the performative aspects of Taoism, chiefly the methods of divination and magic which it promoted. These were brought to Japan by immigrants from China and Korea who imported them without the baggage of a centralized religious order. By the mid and late 600s, as Crown Prince Naka was staging his coup against the Soga and then afterward writing reforms to transform the Yamato court from a confederation into a centralized monarchy, Taoist influence can already be seen on the decorations we find on artifacts from the period. Crown Prince Naka, you'll hopefully remember, eventually took the throne as King Tenji, and later left behind a massive succession crisis from which his brother would emerge triumphant and be remembered as Emperor Temmu, the first Tenno. Temmu attributed his victory, in part, to his skill at divination. Although today it does not possess the influence it once did, divination has been practiced the world over for thousands of years. In the West, Roman armies would consult various forms of divining, whether it was studying portents like falling stars or removing and interpreting an animal's liver. The Chinese forms of divination, which interested Temmu and the other Japanese leaders, revolved around choosing the proper day and time of performing a certain action. The signs, the diviners would argue, were all around us. Does not the earth have its own natural rhythms, seasons, and natural cycles? Why shouldn't the universe as well hem to its own natural ebbing and flowing? The man who became Emperor Temmu certainly believed that this divination and magic had power, and power is something that must be controlled. Thus he embarked upon a civic quest, one taken up by his wife Empress Jito after his death. The power to divine auspicious days and discern the secrets of the universe absolutely could not be left in the hands of anyone except the imperial court. As newcomers from Baekje, Koguryo, and China flocked to Japan's shores in the wake of both conquest and marginalization, the imperial court of the late 600s actively gathered divination practitioners of all stripes and set them to work on the emperor's behalf. The Nara court would later continue this aggressive monopolization of the spiritual world. If you're interested in reading a more granular analysis of this process, I highly recommend the book Imperial Politics and Symbolics in Ancient Japan by Herman Ooms. This book is a fascinating study of the relationship between spirituality and politics in the Asuka and Nara periods. As divination and magic became the exclusive province of the court, it had an effect on how the court saw its enemies, as well as itself. When plots against the Tenno were put into the historical record, it was expected that the insurgents would also be accused of some kind of forbidden or evil magic. Casting a spell, or even just attempting one, without first obtaining royal permission, was a nearly guaranteed way of getting yourself charged with treason if you were caught. Likewise, various punishments were devised for magical practitioners who wandered the land and did not act with the court's blessing. By the end of the Asuka period, the Yamato court had evolved from a rough confederation of warring clans into a rapidly centralizing state. Yes, that's right. We can't call it fully centralized yet, because the regional powers outside of the Kansai region still wielded considerable local authority, which, although it was being gradually eroded by the awarding of imperial titles, was still a practical reality. Tenmu and Jito had sowed the seeds of a central state whose authority extended over the invisible world itself. It was Empress Genmei, however, who would reap the harvest as she expanded the mystical aura of the imperial court into the next logical step in the process of state building, sponsoring the first written texts documenting the founding myths of Japan. Until then, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at @ahistoryofjapan. Visit the online store, ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com, and find us on the web, ahistoryofjapan.com.